From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu claims victory, but parliamentary election results still too close to call. UN Commission calls for Syria War Crimes Tribunal. First Lady Michelle Obama heads to Asia on an education mission. A spider bite may be good for your health, we'll explain. These and other stories coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. The Israeli parliamentary elections are over, but the final results are still unclear. Both major candidates are predicting they will be the one to form a new government, even while TV exit polls show their race is too close to call. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, looking for a fourth term, already declared victory for his conservative Likud party, writing on Facebook that Likud won against all odds. Isaac Herzog of the left-leaning Zionist Union Alliance says everything is open until the final results are in. No candidate is expected to win a 61-seat parliamentary majority. VOA Scott Bob reports from Jerusalem.
The unofficial results indicate that the United List of four Arab-led parties is poised to become the third largest group in the parliament. United List leaders have said they would support the center-left alliance led by opposition leader Isaac Herzog, but they would not join in any coalition government. As a result, many believe that centrist parties could determine who forms the next government. Israelis voted in large numbers after a last-minute push by candidates to turn out the vote. In Jerusalem's working-class neighborhood of Katamonim, 74-year-old Esther Dabul went to the polls in her wheelchair. She says everyone should come and vote with her. It is good that they vote, she says, for the people to become stronger, to be together, hand in hand, one heart, one soul. Office worker Sadi Levy, a divorced mother of two, says that socioeconomic issues are her highest priority. She says she wants the government to take care of the weak, the elderly, those who cannot afford housing, young couples. She adds that for the sake of her children, she also would like the new government to restart the stalled peace negotiations with the Palestinians. Mr. Netanyahu, seeking an unprecedented fourth term, underscored his record as a strong leader who would protect Israel's security. Herzog said Mr. Netanyahu had failed to deliver on his promises to reduce the cost of living and shrink the gap between rich and poor. The unity list of four Arab-led parties attracted some Israeli voters to the polls for the first time. One of these was 30-year-old teacher Wafa Awad, who voted in the predominantly Arab neighborhood Beit Safafa. She says this is the first time she is voting because she has a feeling there is something new, especially since the Arab-led parties joined together. She adds she hope Arab Israelis get a positive result out of it. Lawyer Osama Saadi says the United List would be a force for positive change for Arab Israelis, who form 20% of the Israeli population but are underrepresented in government and civil service.
This is a very big difference, and we want to use this power in order to make influence at the map in Israel and to achieve a just peace, democracy, and a full right equality for our people.
Once the official results are in, Israeli President Reuven Rivlin, after consulting with each party, is to designate one of their leaders to forge the new government. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
In Washington, White House spokesman Josh Earnest said the Obama administration will work with whoever ends up the election winner.
President Obama remains committed to working very closely with the winner of the ongoing elections to cement and further deepen the strong relationship between the United States and Israel.
Just under 72% of Israel's eligible voters cast their ballots throughout Israel on Tuesday, the highest since 1999. Iran's nuclear chief says Iranian officials have reached a mutual understanding with the United States and its negotiating partners on most issues in nuclear talks. Ali Akbar Saleh says one important difference remains that officials will try to resolve during their talks in Switzerland. In Washington Tuesday, White House spokesman Josh Earnest said there is a 50% chance at best of reaching an agreement. Negotiators are trying to get closer to an outline of an agreement that would ensure Iran's nuclear program is peaceful in exchange for easing economic sanctions that have hurt Iran's economy. The two sides have set a deadline to reach a framework deal by the end of this month. Syrian state media say the Syrian military shot down a U.S. drone conducting a surveillance mission. There are no details on the alleged incident in Latakia province along the Mediterranean coast. A U.S. official says contact was lost with the drone over Syria but gave no other information. If it's true, it will be the first U.S. aircraft shot down over Syria since a U.S.-led coalition battling Islamic State in Iraq expanded airstrikes into Syria in September. Also Tuesday, the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights accused Syrian government forces of dropping barrel bombs filled with poison gas on the town of Sarmin in Idlib province. The observatory says the attack killed six people, including three children. A Syrian military source called the report propaganda and said the government would never use such a weapon. The UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria is calling for the establishment of a special tribunal to bring alleged perpetrators of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Syria to account for their actions. The commission found gross and widespread human rights violations, as we hear in this report from Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
The four-member Commission of Inquiry says a culture of impunity is flourishing in Syria. It says those who continue to commit violations of international law have nothing to fear, as it appears they are unlikely to be held accountable for their actions. Since it was established in August 2011, the Commission has repeatedly called on the UN Security Council to refer alleged perpetrators of war crimes in Syria to the International Criminal Court. Such action has been blocked by a threatened veto from Russia, which backs Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Faced with this reality, Commission member Karen Abu Zaid tells VOA the hope of bringing cases to the ICC is no longer there. So, she says, the Commission is proposing alternative ways of bringing perpetrators of atrocities to justice.
When you say, have we given up hope about the ICC, one reason we are suggesting other things like ad hoc tribunal, universal jurisdiction, national jurisdiction, is because that will be a substitute for the ICC. If we can't get these things through the ICC, which would also be the case for the ad hoc tribunal, then we hope that some other places we can get through to the governments to do that.
Alternative solutions include having the General Assembly, which is not subject to a veto by the five nuclear powers, refer cases to the ICC. The General Assembly also could set up an ad hoc tribunal. Commission Chairman Paulo Pinheiro says such a tribunal would focus only on Syrian cases, unlike the ICC, which deals with cases arising in many countries.
The ad hoc tribunals dedicated to a particular conflict are able to bring many more individuals to prosecution. An ad hoc tribunal could be based in the region, closer to victims, where justice could be done and be seen by affected communities. And finally, as recently we said, in terms of costs, it would be minimal when compared to the actual cost of war.
The UN Commission has a list of alleged Syrian war crime perpetrators, but investigators say they will not make the list public now. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A U.S. Air Force veteran is being charged with trying to provide material support to the IS militant group. A grand jury also indicted Tyrod Nathan Webster Pugh on obstruction of justice charges. Pugh allegedly tried to join the IS group earlier this year, weeks after being fired from his job as an airplane mechanic in the Middle East. Pugh faces up to 35 years in prison if convicted. Another four American aid workers have been flown home to the United States for monitoring following possible exposure to the deadly Ebola virus. Tuesday's arrival brings to 15 the number of Americans flown home from Sierra Leone since last Friday. None of the returned aid workers has developed symptoms of Ebola, but they may have been exposed to the American clinician who came down with Ebola last week while working in West Africa for a Boston-based international aid organization. That man is in critical condition at the NIH hospital in Maryland. Many analysts say Germany has the makings of a global power. They point to Berlin's lead in trying to solve the European financial crisis and its diplomatic efforts to stop the war in Ukraine. Some experts, though, still question whether Germany is ready to play a larger international role. VOA's Jelle Defrancheski examines the extent and limits of Germany's power.
Germany, Europe's economic behemoth, has never been as prosperous, secure, and free as it is today. It is the world's fourth largest economy and one of the world's top exporters. In Washington and Beijing, Germany stands for Europe. 24 years after reunification, Germany has become America's most valuable European partner, says Annette Heuser of the Bertelsmann Foundation in Washington.
When Kissinger was asking the famous question, what is Europe's phone number, I think we can give Henry Kissinger a very solid answer right now, and the number is in Berlin.
But despite its growing influence, Germany has been reluctant to take the lead in larger global affairs, says Stephen Sabo, author of the book Germany, Russia, and the Rise of Geoeconomics.
Its whole idea of being an economic power, not a military or strategic power.
And the question remains,
will Germany stop being a big trading state that concerned only about trading, or will it now begin to rebalance and have a real foreign policy and not just an economic policy?
Sabo acknowledges that Germany's road to great power status is strewn with obstacles. The 2009 Eurozone debt crisis has been managed on Berlin's terms, but 5 years of wrenching austerity measures shifted Europe's political landscape by giving rise to left-wing radicals and right-wing populists. Their sole common ground is resistance to Germany's solutions, says Sabo.
I think there's been a certain degree of arrogance about, we have the right way, you should just follow our way. This is something that they're going to have to address.
Germany's rise to power is happening as the West confronts Russia over Ukraine, while also trying to stem security risks emanating from Islamic extremism, says Daniel Hamilton of the Center for Transatlantic Relations.
All of the turbulence associated with Russia, and then the whole turbulence of the broader Middle East, you know, could intersect at some point and affect Europe per se. All of this can ripple right back into Western Europe, and that's what one sees now, either in flows of people, flows of all sorts of nasty things affecting sort of core Europe.
The crisis on Europe's doorstep has led Berlin to beef up its security presence. Reinhard Bütikofer of the German Council on Foreign Relations says the German military is playing a major role in NATO's new rapid response force created in reaction to Russia's moves in Ukraine.
And the Germans, who are never very eager to sort of get involved militarily, have put troops into some of the Baltic countries, helping these countries that have very weak military protection of their own.
Ending another post-World War II taboo, Berlin is providing arms to Iraqi Kurdish forces battling Islamic State fighters. Experts say Germany's global economic reach depends on the stability of an international political order underpinned by Western strategic power, to which it is now contributing readily. Jelle Defrancheski for VOA News, Washington.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time Saturdays and Sundays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
First Lady Michelle Obama heads out on a five-day trip to Asia today to launch a government initiative called Let Girls Learn to promote the education of millions of girls around the world. Ahead of her visits to Japan and Cambodia, Mrs. Obama and her husband, the president, warned the inability of an estimated 62 million girls to attend school worldwide should be a foreign policy priority. VOA's Victor Beatty has more.
The First Lady wrote in the Wall Street Journal that the fact that tens of millions of girls are not being adequately educated is more than a tragic waste of human potential. It is also, she says, a serious public health challenge, a drag on national economies, as well as global prosperity, and a threat to the security of countries around the world. Mrs. Obama says, as of 2012, every developing region had achieved or was close to achieving gender parity in primary education. But she says a gender gap remains in secondary education, where girls are subjected to, quote, the cultural values and practices that define and limit the prospects of women in their societies. In launching the Let Girls Learn campaign earlier this month, Mrs. Obama said the Peace Corps, the U.S.-funded volunteer development agency, would play a key role.
This effort will draw on the talent and energy of the nearly 7,000 Peace Corps volunteers serving in more than 60 countries. Through this effort, Peace Corps will be supporting hundreds of new community projects to help girls go to school and stay in school. And I want to emphasize that these programs will be community-generated and community-led. They'll be based on solutions devised by local leaders, families, and yes, even the girls themselves.
At the same event, President Obama says his administration is making clear to partner countries this is a foreign policy priority.
We know that when girls are educated, they're more likely to delay marriage. Their future children, as a consequence, are more likely to be healthy and better nourished. Their future wages increase, which in turn strengthens the security of their family. And national growth gets a boost as well. From a political standpoint and a security standpoint, places where women and girls are treated as full and equal citizens tend to be more stable, tend to be more democratic. So this is not just a humanitarian issue. This is an economic issue, and it is a security issue. And that's why it has to be a foreign policy priority.
Mrs. Obama's first stop is Japan, where she will meet Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and his wife, Akie. The Peace Corps and Japan's equivalent overseas cooperation volunteers are to work together on the campaign. Michael Kuchek, an adjunct fellow at Temple University's Institute of Contemporary Asian Studies in Tokyo, says the First Lady's visit is receiving wide press coverage. He says the visit is seen as buttressing the special U.S.-Japan relationship. He also says education has long been a personal priority of the Abes.
Mr. Abe has long been involved in education policy, but in addition, he and his wife run a charity that builds schools in Myanmar, and they've been doing it for actually quite some time. So it's not really out of place for Akie-sama to come forward at this time to meet with very publicly with Michelle Obama on this issue, because she herself has been involved in it.
The First Ladies will meet Japanese university students. Before leaving Japan, Mrs. Obama will also stop in Kyoto to tour a Buddhist temple and Shinto shrine. In Cambodia, the senior director for Asian affairs at the U.S. National Security Council said Mrs. Obama will touch on the need for an open and inclusive political system and to allow civil society to have a role in good governance. Mrs. Obama, the first U.S. lady to visit Cambodia, is scheduled to travel to Siem Reap, where she'll meet her Cambodian counterpart, Bun Rani, wife of Prime Minister Hun Sen, speak with students and volunteers, and see some community programs said to be expanding girls' education opportunities. Before returning to Washington, Mrs. Obama is to visit the ancient temple at Angkor Wat. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Big cities like Chicago, Los Angeles, and in smaller towns through the United States, Americans of many ethnic origins celebrate St. Patrick's Day and all things Irish. In New York, the annual St. Patrick's Day parade is the nation's largest Irish celebration. This year, a controversy continued about whether openly homosexual Irish-American groups should be allowed to march at this year's privately sponsored mega event up Fifth Avenue. VOA's Adam Phillips has more from New York on what happened.
For the first time, the Ancient Order of Hibernians, the Catholic fraternal organization which sponsors the St. Patrick's Day Parade, allowed a gay group to march up Fifth Avenue on Tuesday. But that wasn't concession enough for these two young women, both of whom are Irish-American.
I love gays. They're just like us. Their life. You should let them do what they want.
I 100% agree with her.
But Bill, middle-aged and natty, disagrees.
It's not a government parade. It's by invitation only. And, you know, some things should remain so.
It's an open question whether the parade committee will be more liberal in St. Patrick's days to come. As one tipsy reveler trying to make peace put it, I wish all sides success. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Spiders of any variety are an unwelcome guest in many homes, sending people leaping on top of chairs or in search of a paper towel to crush and dispose of them, making them a piece of insect history. But spiders could actually be a welcome source of pain relief. Their venom contains thousands of proteins, among them some helpful molecules they may someday be made into powerful painkillers. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
Chronic pain is a serious problem. Millions of people have constant discomfort that does not respond to any of the usual medications. In the U.S. alone, the costs of chronic pain are estimated to top $600 billion a year in lost productivity and medical expenses, more than the price tag for cancer, heart disease, and stroke combined. Spiders may hold the key for the development of a new class of painkiller. A research team in Australia rapidly analyzed the venom of 206 species of spider. Many of the proteins in the venom activate pain pathways, causing paralysis and muscle spasticity to capture prey. For people, spider bites can be excruciatingly painful. But among the thousands of compounds in the venom, investigators at the University of Queensland's Institute for Molecular Bioscience identified seven that actually block pain signals from reaching the brain. The findings were published in the British Journal of Pharmacology. Julie Garb, who did not participate in the study, is a spider researcher in the biology department at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell, with a particular interest in venom.
If you could take those toxins that block those channels and kind of turn it into a medicine, then, you know, that would cause those individuals to not be able to, you know, sense the stimulation of those neurons, which would normally cause pain.
It's estimated that there are 9 million proteins in the venom of the world's 45,000 spider species. Only a tiny fraction, 0.01%, of the peptides has so far been investigated for its biological activity, according to Garb.
But then there could be just one component which has a positive, beneficial medical effect. So they're trying to isolate exactly what that is. So if you knew exactly what that is, then you could potentially manufacture it as a drug.
The Australian scientists suggest that the technique they use to screen spider venom reportedly could be used to test other compounds, identifying helpful ones that might be used to make new drugs. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Makers of a prototype flying car have unveiled their latest model at a technology festival in Austin, Texas, promising to have a model available for purchase by 2017. Slovakian company Aeromobile put its flying car on display at the South by Southwest Interactive Conference. The two-seater vehicle runs on standard gasoline and can operate on both the highway and in the air, taking off from a grass or pavement runway of 300 meters or less. The makers say the vehicle, which fits into a standard-sized parking space and auto lane, has a top flight speed of about 200 kilometers per hour and top road speed of about 160 kilometers per hour. The company says the current model, known as the Flying Roadster, will be sold at a cost of several hundred thousand dollars. If the Roadster sells well enough, Aeromobile plans to develop a self-flying model. That's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On March 18, 37 AD, the Roman Senate proclaimed Caligula emperor. Caligula is portrayed by his contemporaries as a cruel tyrant. He was the first Roman emperor to be assassinated. In 1123, the First Lateran Council opened in Rome. Among other things, the council forbade Roman Catholic priests from marrying. On this day in 1314, Jacques de Molay, the 23rd and last Grand Master of the Knights Templar, was burned at the stake. Philip IV of France, deeply in debt to the Templars, had de Molay arrested and killed. In 1776, after 4 months of anti-tax protests in North America, the British Parliament repealed the Stamp Act, a measure enacted to raise revenue for the British Army in the American colonies. On the same day, however, Parliament passed the Declaratory Act, asserting its legislative power over the colonies, which nonetheless declared their independence from Britain the following July. On this day in 1925, one of the worst tornadoes in U.S. history swept through three Midwestern states, killing nearly 700 people and injuring 2,000 more. In 1940, Germany's Adolf Hitler and Italy's Benito Mussolini met at the Brenner Pass in the Alps and agreed to form an alliance against France and the United Kingdom. On this day in 1950, military forces of the Nationalist Chinese government on Taiwan raided mainland China, capturing the town of Sunmen. The United States denied communist allegations that it was behind the attack. On this day in 1965, Soviet cosmonaut Alexei Leonov left his orbiting space capsule and took the first walk in space. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Ukraine is facing the dual challenge of enacting political and economic reforms while at the same time fighting Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. In recent congressional testimony, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs Victoria Nuland said the package of reforms already enacted by Ukrainian lawmakers is impressive. Budget reform has passed, pensions have been capped, and new banking provisions will stiffen penalties for financiers for stripping assets from banks at public expense. With U.S. support, including a $1 billion loan guarantee last year and $355 million in foreign assistance and technical advisors, the Ukrainian government is able to help vulnerable Ukrainians affected by necessary economic reforms, improve energy efficiency, create a transparent government procurement process, and put a newly trained force of beat cops on the streets of Kiev. Even as Ukraine is building a peaceful, democratic, and independent nation, Crimea and parts of eastern Ukraine are suffering a reign of terror, said U.S. Assistant Secretary Nuland in her testimony. Today, Crimea remains under illegal occupation, and human rights abuses are the norm, not the exception, for many at-risk groups there. Crimean Tatars, Ukrainians who won't surrender their passports, journalists, LGBT citizens, and others. In eastern Ukraine, Russia and its separatist puppets unleashed unspeakable violence and pillage. This manufactured conflict, fueled by Russian tanks and heavy weapons, has cost the lives of more than 6,000 Ukrainians and hundreds of young Russians sent to fight and die there. Throughout this conflict, the U.S. and the European Union have together imposed successive rounds of tough sanctions. More sanctions will be forthcoming unless the latest ceasefire agreement is fully implemented. This means that in the coming days, there must be a complete ceasefire in all parts of eastern Ukraine. Full unfettered access to the whole conflict zone, including all separatist-held territory, and a full pullback of all heavy weapons under OSCE monitoring and verification. The United States' commitment to Ukraine is about more than protecting the choice of a single European country, said Assistant Secretary Nuland. It's about protecting our 25-year American investment in the prospect of a Europe whole, free, and at peace, and the example that sets for nations and people around the world who want more democratic, prosperous futures.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.